It's Northeast Delta Dental Radio with Tom Raffio.
Welcome to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. I'm Tom Raffio for Northeast Delta Dental Radio, and I'm also the head coach of the dental insurance company known as Northeast Delta Dental. Well, it's hard to believe it's already October 3rd and 4th, depending on when you're listening to this. If you're listening to this on Saturday, October 3rd, we're right after the 9 a.m. news. And if you're listening to this on Sunday, October 4th, we're right after the 7 a.m. news. I want to give a big shout-out to Dr. Mitch Caray, who joined me on last week's show to talk about how we're all dealing with the world of COVID in the dental chair, and specifically that while we all want to recognize that the World Health Organization is a reputable organization, they're not necessarily always correct, and we have been seeing people in the dental offices really in New Hampshire since May 11th quite safely. There is not one case of COVID transmission in the dental chair. And, of course, to prevent emergencies, you should go on a preventative basis. Unfortunately, WHO came out with a sort of a stale announcement indicating that you should only go for emergencies. And while that certainly may be true for certain countries in the world, and WHO, of course, represents the entire world, it's not so in the United States. So Dr. Mitch Caray and I explain that. This weekend, though, with me is the world-famous Professor Annabelle Burrell, who has written a number of books, including one that we co-authored. She was the primary, Annabelle was the primary, on mindfulness, A Better Me, A Better You, A Better World. My role in that book was kind of the pragmatic implementation Annabelle's and mindfulness's ideas, and I think as may come out in this show, that's really been helpful in terms of Northeast Delta Dental, navigating and shepherding this kind of period of time that we're in semi-crisis. Today's topic, though, is leadership in the time of crisis. Professor Burrell, thank you for joining me this weekend. I really appreciate it. I know you're constantly writing, wonderful writer. I love reading your stuff on mindfulness and in the spirit of transparency. Annabelle works with many of our employees here on mindfulness and a number of topics, even in the virtual world. So let's start there, Annabelle. How has the virtual world affected you? I was thinking and preparing for this show to some extent may have made it easier to write because, well, it's never easy to write. I'll start there. But since everybody's virtual, you're used to that. On the other hand, I'm assuming training, at least initially, was a little bit more difficult. So tell us in your own professional life what COVID has meant in terms of, training and the adaptations you've made.
Sure. Well, first of all, Tom, good to connect with you. And as always, an honor to be on the show.
The honor is mine, trust me, so go ahead.
No, not at all. And I just want to get in, I do want to get in a plug for the mindfulness that you have shepherded through Northeast Delta Dental. And I do believe that the people who participate in the weekly mindfulness sessions, I don't just believe, I know because they say so and one can hear it. It really does help. So between the mindfulness and your very clear, calm, constant reassurance that you give them, they're doing better than other organizations and other people that I know of. So kudos to you on that one.
Oh, thank you. And it's been something I feel like I'm more connected, ironically, with my employee colleagues, most of whom I would consider, if not all of them, friends. I mean, we all went through this together in our sort of world of the dental space. On March 16th, everything changed when the American Dental Right. Association said only emergency. So, I mean, again, in the spirit of transparency, we had to, temporarily furlough a number of people, all of whom have come back unless they chose to retire. And in that process, every day was communicating both with active employees and with furloughed employees, and I definitely feel connected. And I did learn something interesting in that communication. I think by sort of being transparent and sort of sharing that I may be feeling the same sense of loss and fears that they do, as well as providing different personal stories. That seems to have really resonated. And this company, I think, thanks to our employees, I mean, we're back. We're processing faster and more accurately than the pre-COVID level. So I want to thank my colleagues at Delta Dental, but also the dentists and hygienists who made a super commitment to training and being safe. So with that, you have your latest book is Leadership in the Time of Crisis. The title, I think, will be Rethinking Leadership: A Critique of Contemporary Theories. But tell us again what you've learned in terms of the skills needed during a time of crisis.
Sure. Well, I have found that particularly this crisis has shaken people to the core, and that's there's no surprise because it has really taken in every domain. It has taken everything that we were quote-unquote used to or considered normal or took for granted. It is it is all crumbled. So what I'm seeing and what I'm learning for myself too is, first of all, the importance of leadership. People need effective, empathic, thoughtful, calm, leaders who have an ability to not only think on a broader landscape, if you like, but they also have emotional complexity that they can move back and forth between what I call the technical work, which is getting things done, keeping the train on the track, so to speak, keeping people working, keeping people safe, and the adaptive work, which I talk about, which is so much what you mentioned briefly a moment ago, is about connection. It's about empathy. It's about understanding the losses that come with change. And when there's a huge crisis, as we are enduring now, and I use the word enduring on purpose because I think we're in for a bit of a long haul here, This loss is significant, and I'm seeing that myself. I'm working mostly from home, and people want to connect, and we're all in the Zoom world now. But the importance of connection and making it a meaningful one is essential. So I think a lot of skills are going to have to be honed by many leaders in terms of how to be more adept at handling these types of challenging times, these radically uncertain times, and the essentiality of, again, what you mentioned, not only empathic, but you mentioned that you met people where they were by talking about your own vulnerability. And as I've spoken to some of the Northeast Delta dental people, they really appreciate the daily call. They appreciate your visibility. They appreciate your keeping them in the know of what you know. And that takes self-confidence. It takes a calmness. It takes an ability to really deal with these, with uncertain times without making promises that can't be kept.
I think that last point is so important. I try to project a realistic optimism, but also never, ever suggesting something that, that's not going to happen. The other thing I found actually most recently was just by talking about the fact that there are days, I don't know if you've ever felt this way, but there are days where I'm thinking, oh, this isn't so bad. I don't have to get into a suit and make a speech at 8 o'clock at night. I can be home.
I know the feeling.
And so like for really probably most of my career, I did not make it home for dinner time. Now I do because I try to get out of here before the building is clean. We have a process where 3/4 of our employees are working virtually, about 1/4 of us are still on campus, and we're all socially distanced. But once we're done with our day, I like to get out before the professional cleaners come in, so they can do a real thorough job with them. So I'm actually getting home for dinner. So I was sharing this the other day with managers and others, but I can live with this. Then there are other days where I wake up and I say, oh my God, how can I possibly do one more Zoom televideo? How can I do email? And I have to kind of snap out of it. But I think just by basically saying that, and they know that, because I know that particularly those people that have been basically working virtually since roughly March 23rd, I mean, at least I have the connections of the on-campus people, so I can't imagine how they're feeling. So I just think that it is so important to be, authentic. Usually crises arise because early hints and cues maybe were ignored. So do you think there were warning signals, this time around?
Oh, I do think. And I'm running a seminar now, called Rethinking Leadership. And it has two parts to it. But in the first part, we actually look at the number of examples of where people didn't follow cues. Anyway, just to answer this specific pandemic, I mean, there were virologists saying that a major pandemic is going to occur very soon. And they were saying this in the early 2000s. And then even George W. Bush put a pandemic plan in place, which was then just, kind of frittered away. Now, if we go back to the Wuhan, I'll just make this a personal quick story. The Wuhan, that it first began at the end of November. There were the first little inklings. And in mid-January, I was planning a trip to New Zealand. And I was talking to this friend of mine down out there, John, and we were going back and forth, and he was involved in the SARS drama, SARS, many, the beginning of this century. And I said to him, what do you think about this? And he said, wow, this could be another SARS thing. And I said, John, do you think I should come to New Zealand? This is mid-January. I said, I have an inkling this is going to get out of hand. And on the 23rd of January, I pulled the plug. And this is little me without the WHO telling me what to do or any other advice. It's just, and this is, I mean, you could call it a fluke on my part.
Well, I think you listened to some input.
You
had the intuition. So hold the thought, and we'll continue.
Okay, sure.
We'll continue that. And if people want to get a hold of Annabelle, it's AnnabelleBurrell.com. And those of you that want to get our mindfulness book, you can get that at Gibson, or you can go on Amazon, and it's there. And the great thing about that book is it has the science behind it, thanks to Professor Burrell, and then it has some practical advice. And you'll see some major turnaround stories of some of my employee colleagues kind of in a composite way. Welcome back to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. Tom Raffia with Professor Annabelle Burrell this weekend, October 3rd and 4th, and we've been talking about leadership in times of crisis, and specifically, are there hints and cues that perhaps were ignored? And I know one of the things I did when the sort of egg, for lack of a better term, when the egg sort of hit the fan in the first quarter of this year, the first thing I did is I read three books. I read John Barry's book on the plagues of the plague of 1918-19 during World War One, and I was thinking, oh my God! Not only did they have the so-called Spanish flu, but they also had probably one of the worst wars ever in terms of death,
right.
And yet humankind survived. Then the other thing I did was I read Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. Of plague in London, way, 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 way back, and then I read Albert Camus' book, having to do with the plague in the early part of the 20th century, and so I kind of got a handle on on that aspect, that this has been going on forever, but now, of course, with now we have whatever it is, 6 billion people instead of 1 billion people, and with all the flying that we do, that this could be really bad. So you picked up a cue, you were saying, in January and decided not to make a trip to New Zealand. And of course, New Zealand, by the way, I guess they now have a few more COVID cases, but for a while they were sort of bragging that they had eradicated
yes.
COVID. But in any event, so these hints and cues you picked up on, and what do you think in terms of why were you able to pick it up where maybe others were saying, including people that are really well-renowned, like, oh, don't worry about it. I mean, at some point, if you trace back, let's say Dr. Fauci, I know he's a man of stature, a doctor of stature, but at some point he was saying, oh, don't worry about it, and you don't have to wear masks. And then, of course, and I know we all evolve, you know, with data, but you picked up the cue. And so how do you think you picked up that cue?
Well, I will say two things. Well, first of all, I was going to fly through Singapore and Australia. And Singapore, I think in the, and thankfully I didn't, because Singapore got hit fairly quickly, fairly soon, I think, as did Australia. But back to how did I pick up the clue? You know, Tom, I think what has helped me is that I make it my business to all the time be looking out for new realities. And I think it's part of my training. I worked for an amazing man when I was in my early 30s, and he was head of strategic planning of one of the biggest banks in the United Kingdom. And he was always telling me, Alibel, small things always turn into big things. Keep your eyes open. And he really taught me an enormous amount. So it's become a kind of way, it's become a way of life in a way to always be questioning. And I think it has helped me and the people I know who are, I think, effective leaders. Well, like yourself, I mean, you got on the mindfulness, fairly quickly and early. They are always scanning the horizon, always saying, well, what's happening out there? You know, what might happen? And being in touch with one's intuition is so important, which, again, I think the mindfulness can help, you know, just slowing down and letting things percolate in your mind. Because if you're caught up running around, multitasking, never really letting anything process, it can't really land. So I would just say that's helped me.
And that unitasking, not multitasking, you beat me to the punch on that one. I was going to say that's probably one of the most, at least in my definition, one of the most fundamental things about mindfulness. Be present, do one thing at a time, and that does help you, you know, focus, you know, on those cues that others might miss by being a, you know, human doer instead of a, you know, a human being. So now we know... as you mentioned, you know, crises do cause emotional distress, and you're writing this new book on leadership in a time of crisis. Some leaders, I assume, might be spending a lot of time on the technical side of it. For example, making sure that everybody has the right, you know, desktop computers at home and the right chairs. But don't they also need to spend some time on the emotional distress? And if you had to say, it probably varies like a lot of things, but if you said, you know, should the leader be spending, you know, 20 on technology and, you know, 80 on emotional distress, or 50-50, what's your, you know, and I know the answer probably depends, but why don't you discuss both the technology and the emotional side?
Sure. No, that's a great question. In times of crisis, as you know, the first thing one has to do is the technical work. You have to get everybody safe, and that really means thinking through what are the technical, you know, things that need to be done. And the technical work, so work is always the procedural work. It's always the doing things. But fairly soon afterwards, So once one's sort of got some handle on that, it's important to begin the adaptive work, which is looking at the what I call the value tensions. What is it from a psychological and emotional point of view, is really hitting people? And it always starts with one major question is, how is this crisis, how is this distress impacting people's self-understanding? Their self-understanding of who they are, how they are in the world, their relationship to the world, what's happening to their values, what's happening to their sense of competence, will they be okay, what'll happen to their relationships. So it's always around self-understanding. And in a crisis, well, like ours, it's kind of back and forth. But I would say that one needs to, you know, do the two, technical and adaptive, in tandem. But fairly early on, one needs to do a fair amount of adaptive work. I would say at least 50% of the time needs to be around steadying people psychologically. And maybe even more, could be even 60 or 70, because if you don't, the technical work will not be done. They won't stay at home. They won't grasp that they can't have parties with 80 people. They won't understand the purpose of masks. They will fight it because that's their way to fight the reality. So it's a kind of displaced, anger, fear is going into fighting the reality. Instead of if they could be rallied and show that, hey, which is what you're doing at Northeast Delta Den, we're all in this together. We're all in the same boat, and there's only one boat, and we better all be rowing in the same direction.
Exactly.
Let me help you. And so that's where the adaptive work is really, I would say, at least half of the work that needs to be done for some period of time.
I love the way you model this, which was so well put. Which is, you first have to make sure people are safe. Get them out get them out of the office. Make sure that their home offices are set up with the right technology and security and ergonomics, et cetera. But then fairly quickly, you've got to get to the psychological, because just what you said, even with the best technology, if they're fretting, if they're concerned about their livelihood, their family, it doesn't matter if they have the best technology.
Right.
I love the way you put that. Let's kind of switch gears just quickly on sort of the macro of leadership development, which according to Forbes, we spend over $160 billion on that, corporations, that is. And yet, studies seem to show that the ROI is poor. Now, you recently wrote still another book called Ethical Leadership in Global Capitalism, A Guide to Good Practice. And so you basically make the point that great leadership is hard to find sometimes, and that unethical and ineffective leadership does, in fact, it's around a lot. So what else did you learn in doing that book?
In doing the ethical leadership book?
Yes.
Here's what was really a common theme, which I thought was so interesting, and is that this what I write in this current book is called willful blindness.
Wow.
How people get, for whatever reason, get caught up in unethical behavior for all kinds of reasons, a lot of it is group pressure. They do not want to be the one who squeals, the one who squeaks, whatever. And this denial of the reality that people know that things shouldn't be happening are happening. I mean, look at the Volkswagen scandal, look at the Wells Fargo. I mean, we could just look at many of them. And again, what comes up, as I mentioned in this book, is that we don't like to face unpalatable truths. And that is something that I think is where leadership or leaders need to role model courage.
I love
courage
it.
Courage to face the truth.
I love
be
it.
Be it about unethicality. And again, you know, yeah, looking things in the eye and saying, yep, it's pretty damn bad, but you know what? We will always get through it, especially if we pull together.
I love the way you put it. Now, my other favorite author besides you is Max DeVries in Leadership as an Art, and the book
He's wonderful. I love him, too.
And that book, basically, one of the things I picked up on him is that a leader has to be authentic and describe, you know, the truth, and that's being a servant leader. So Annabelle can be reached at AnnabelleBurrell, all one word, .com. The latest book is coming out is Rethinking Leadership, A Critique of Contemporary Theories, and that gets into some of the current crisis management. The other book that I referenced is Ethical Leadership and Global Capitalism. And finally, the book that I participated with Annabelle on, Mindfulness, A Better Me, A Better You, A Better World. In 30 seconds, in light of what's happened, do you think leaders, I think the answer is obvious, but I'll ask you to answer it. How do you think leaders should prepare for a future crisis, and should they?
That's a great question, Tom. I certainly think they should. And I think one place to begin is that they should come together. You know, this is another big thing that happens in crises, is that everybody isolates and people feel alone, and leaders need to help one another. So I think they should prepare. They should do some technical preparation. You know, have responder teams and have crisis planning and whatever. But I think they should prepare themselves. They should have a look at, you know, can they be calm? Can they not be reactive? Can they not let their egos get in the way when such big things are at stake and everybody's terrified?
I love
it. You know, can they take a systemic viewpoint? You know, get on the balcony and look at the bigger picture and not just run around, you know, doing something for the sake of saying I'm doing something.
So as you can see, I think my CEO colleagues out there, anybody, families listening to this, Annabelle can be reached at AnnabelleBurrell.com. The books I've referenced, Ethical Leadership and Global Capitalism, Mindfulness, A Better Me, A Better You, and the latest one, Rethinking Leadership, A Critique of Contemporary Theories. You'll love Annabelle's writing style as well. Annabelle Burrell, Professor Burrell, thank you for joining me this weekend.
Oh, a great pleasure, Tom, and good for you, and, you know,
and
hang in there as you steer that boat of yours.